Yes, Brother Mike, and good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, I dare say there are many people who wish this chapter had never been written. There are some who shy away from even considering it in any detail. But if we do, brothers and sisters, we fly in the face of divine wisdom that has seen fit to record it for all posterity. You know, David may have wished that the events that occurred here had never occurred. But even so, after they had, he later rejoiced that it had been revealed. And he said in Psalm 51 that he wanted to teach sinners in the way as a result of all that had happened. So David, in his own mind, had turned the entire horrific experience in his life into something that was positive, that could teach sinners in the way. And so tonight, we want David to teach us. You know, in a strange way, brothers and sisters, we can be mightily thankful that God's revealed these events and not kept them secret. He could have kept them secret. There are many, many things in the lives of many faithfuls, including David, that have been kept secret, that have not been revealed to all the eyes of the world. But we can be thankful that God has revealed what he has to us in the life of this man. Because, you know, brothers and sisters, here we have the whole process of forgiveness by the grace of God revealed in the life and the heart of a single man. There is no greater account of true repentance in the whole of the Old Testament, and probably very few, if any, in the New. Because this story tells us not only about the forgiveness that David received, it tells us an enormous amount about the God that David loved. So why did this happen to this man? He was such an amazing character. Everything we look at until this point in time about David's life shines as a beam of sunlight to any who read it. And he was not a perfect man completely, we know. And there are things even recorded in his life up until this point where he wished he would have done different things. But he's such an amazing character in terms of his relationship with his God. There is probably no other in the entire Old Testament who ever had that same intensity of relationship with God. Now, it's not wise for us to even make as bold assertions to that, but I only do that on this basis, that we have revealed to us the depth of his relationship through the Psalms. There is no character whose inmost thoughts are opened to us as they are in the life of this man. And what drove him and what motivated him? Just let me read you a few words. This is the man that was the man after God's own heart. He said, in an earlier day, Yahweh rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands hath he recompensed me. I have kept the ways of Yahweh, I have not wickedly departed from my God, for all his judgments were before me, and I did not put away his statutes from me. I was also upright before him, and I kept myself from my iniquity. Therefore hath Yahweh recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands in his eyesight. That's not a vain boast on David's part, brothers and sisters. It's divinely inspired. It's the truth about a mighty servant of God. Yet perhaps herein lies part of the reason why we have revealed the incidents of 2 Samuel 11 and 12. This was a man after God's own heart. He did achieve mighty things. He took the kingdom of Israel and united it. He brought God into the midst. He brought it to the pinnacle. He took it out to the boundaries that were promised to Abraham. But he was not Messiah. He was this whole historical account was still only a type. And this man, like you and I, are flawed. He, like us, sinned. He was not the sinless one who would come. And perhaps God was going to reveal in the life of one that was so close to him what it meant to sin and return. You know, all the events and circumstances of David's life, of all of them, you know, and it covers, I think, something like 80-odd chapters in the historical record. Out of all the events that occur, there'd be few that we are as familiar with as these events surrounding his sin. It's sad that we're not more familiar with others, but I think it's probably true that everyone is probably very familiar with these events. But perhaps they are, brethren and sisters, some of those things that are so little appreciated by us all. And I speak for myself as well. Because here we have the real and relevant issues of our lives being touched in this man's experience here. Because all of us, brethren and sisters, are assailed by sin. We're all hijacked and taken captive at the will of a power that we wish we could control. And we all feel the wretchedness of estrangement from God. And David's going to teach us through the tears of his experience how we can return to God and find abiding fellowship with him. If we never had this incident recorded, brethren and sisters, we would never have the mighty mind of David to lift us to those heights through an experience like this. Perhaps David, being the sort of man he was, intense, committed in absolutely everything he did, reached great heights in the spiritual realm, but when he fell to a depth that possibly few of us would ever get to. But therein lies the lesson for us too, and I suppose overarching all of this whole incident is the words of the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 10, when he said, "Let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." We're not here, brethren and sisters, to make judgment on David. God alone can do that. We don't get up to David's bootlace, most of us. So it's of no value to us to gloat in anything that David did, but to listen carefully to this wise and wonderful man as he comes through the experience of a purging that changed his life forever. Well, we left David in our last class at the pinnacle of his kingdom, at the absolute pinnacle, with him administering justice and judgment and showing mercy. That's how the record in Samuel left us. And then, as the record told us about this, finally there was a provocation from the Ammonites that David had to control, and he moved his forces out there. And the Syrians came down from the north and in great force to back up the Ammonites. And Joab and David's armies defeated the Syrians and winter closed in. The Ammonites were left and the Syrians absolutely beaten, but the Ammonites were yet to be controlled. And that's where the chapter starts. Verse 1. It came to pass after the year was expired, at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David tarried still at Jerusalem. At a time when kings go forth to battle, this one didn't. And yet, did you notice in verse 1 there, it said, all Israel went. That means the entire army. Not just the standing army, but all the called up army as well went. And David didn't. That's pointed, isn't it? David didn't. David, at this time in his life, is around, well, somewhere late 40s, I would think. Between 45 and 50, probably. Though we can't be absolutely sure. He had, prior to this, been mightily successful. He had united the nation, as we said before. He'd brought God into the midst. He'd established the worship. He'd had the people settled, and there was judgment and justice being executed among the people. And the people loved him. He was almost hero worshipped in the nation. And around about, their borders had been extended and their enemies had gone down in miraculous victories, and great fame had spread throughout all the world because of him. And God was in everything that he did. That's what the divine penman says. God was behind everything that he did. And the nation was prosperous as tribute poured in over the borders. And now he decides not to go to war. All of those battles that David had fought before were spiritual ones, and they represented the warfare of faith, the battle that we are fighting in type against wickedness in high places. So for David not to go forth to battle, for David to stay back when all his men and the entire army all went, to finally do the last, to finish off the last of these great battles. For David not to go to war tells us something, brothers and sisters. It tells us that there's something wrong in David's life at the moment. It doesn't say what, but it's not long before we find out. He's lost direction, or at least he's spiritually low. Now, we don't want to point the finger at David, brothers and sisters, but we all know that feeling. We've all been there. Things have gone very well for a very long time, and now he's just taking his leisure. He's taking a break, and we find David in Jerusalem when everyone else is in the field fighting the armies that are defying the living God. David is taking his leisure. David is idle. David has time on his hands. He's on his bed, and then he's on his roof, and he's wandering. He's not actually looking for trouble, brothers and sisters, but he's mighty vulnerable in that circumstance. And because of the great prosperity and the success that he's experienced, those things are not good for spirituality. And David should have been fighting. You know, brothers and sisters, just in passing, perhaps, we ought to recognize that idleness and leisure are not blessings, but grave trials. And we are surrounded by those experiences. And we sometimes mistakenly think they are blessings. We even talk like that sometimes. As if great prosperity and great amount of time to ourselves is a marvellous blessing. It's a great curse, brethren and sisters, as David found. And in this state, David was going to fight an even greater enemy than the Ammonites, where Israel and Joab and Abishai were at that time. And not only that, while Joab and Abishai were going to have a great victory over the Ammonites, the fight that David was left to fight on his own as a solitary man in Jerusalem, he was going to lose. Proverbs 16 says, "He that ruleth his spirit is better than he that taketh a city." David was easily able to take a city, especially when he trusted in God. But to rule one's spirit is a different thing. You know, there's a break here at the end of verse 1. You can see the paragraph, little marker in verse where verse 2 starts. So it still starts talking about, you know, fighting the children of Ammon, and that the whole context changes. Turn the page and come to chapter 12 and verse 26, and the record continues, and Joab fought against Rabbah, the children of Ammon, and took the royal city. You know, there's been a slice put in the middle of this record of this fight against Ammon. If you look at the Chronicles record, there's no thing cut out. It just continues, just reads straight on as if it goes from verse 1 right through to verse 26, just without any break. That's how the Chronicles record reads. But the Samuel record here has this incident of David being in Jerusalem inserted right in the middle. It's like it's in parenthesis. So from verse 2 of chapter 11 right through to verse 25 of chapter 12 is a little subsection that's just in parenthesis. It's sliced in the middle of this war with the Ammonites. Because what it's trying to tell us, brethren and sisters, is that there was not one war here. David was still going to fight a war, even though he hadn't gone with his army. David was still going to fight a war. There was one war going on in Jerusalem and another one going on over near Ammon at Rabbah. Two wars going on simultaneously, and they're sliced together here to illustrate that. You know what, brothers and sisters, it actually tells us the kind of war that David was fighting was the real application of what all those other wars were about. This is the real, real war. Oh, pulling down bricks and, you know, taking a city and putting people under tribute. That wasn't really what God was ever, ever interested. He was interested in a war by faith that was going to conquer the spirit. And David's now fighting that alone. With none of his companions there, none of his generals, just him alone. And verse 2 says, "And it came to pass in an eventide that David rose from off his bed," tells us where he is, "and walked upon the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon." I don't think there's a single hint in any part of the scriptures that puts any blame on Bathsheba in this record. David takes the entire blame from start to finish himself. But you know, David had little in his mind at this stage. He wasn't looking for trouble, but when his eyes caught the woman, who was very beautiful, instead of dismissing that thought, he harboured it. Because the law of God was not strong at that moment in his heart, like it had been on so many other occasions. In fact, for almost all his life, he dismissed thoughts of sin, whatever they were, in any circumstance, and ruled his spirit with incredible integrity. And yet here, on this occasion, when he was unsuspecting, in a moment of idleness, a thought grabbed and took hold. You know, David was a godly and upright man, but he did appear to have a weakness. And he had added wives successively through his life. Even after he left Hebron, he added more wives, and when he got to Jerusalem, he had more wives, and then he had more concubines, and he had taken women into his house for his use. And polygamy was therefore a very grave thing for David, really, because it left his eyes open always for women, beautiful women, And now he caught the eyes, he caught sight of another. You know, God knew the circumstances that were going to occur that day. God did not set this up so that David would fall, but God knew the circumstances that would arise. And in his wisdom, had already planned a marvellous scheme to perfect this man in his character and his development spiritually. Well, verse 3 tells us that David sent and inquired after the woman. I suppose there was nothing wrong with inquiring. And the message came back that it was Bathsheba, the daughter of the oath, her name means, that she was the son of a lion. God is my kinsman, his name means, and she was the wife of Uriah, the light of God. The wife of Uriah the Hittite, a converted Gentile, one of the heathen who was faithful to David. In fact, this whole family was faithful. The father of a lion was Ahithophel. And so now, for three generations, we have a faithful family. But the key word in that verse is the word wife. And as soon as David heard it, that should have been the end of his inquiry. You know, this family, and when he heard the names, he obviously hadn't recognized who this woman was, but when he heard the names, that should have been another alarm bell in his mind. Because Uriah and a lion were both part of David's Giborim, the mighty men. They were part of his greatest warriors, that is, the captains of hosts in his army, numbered among the 37 greatest men in the kingdom. So he knew them well. They were very loyal and faithful individuals. But David is low and doesn't fight. And already the thought that crossed his mind has taken root. Verse 4, and David sent messengers and took her, and she came in unto him. He lay with her, for she was purified from her uncleanness, and she returned to her house. You know what James says, brethren and sisters, when lust hath conceived. In fact, it says when a man is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. So the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes and pride of life are themselves not sin. They're part of what we are. But lusts can become inflamed and we can become enticed. And it's only when lust conceives that it brings forth sin. And sin, when it's finished, brings forth death. What was going to happen here, brethren and sisters, it was certainly going to go that the process had started and could not be stopped. It needs to be stopped earlier, but it was not stopped. And so Uriah was to die. This process was going to go right through to death. Uriah was going to die. There were going to be a host of soldiers who were also going to die. There was going to be the child of that union that was going to die. And then Amnon. And then Absalom. And then Adonijah. And then thousands of others in Israel who got caught up in Adonijah's this train of this single little thought that took root in his mind was going to bring a terrible train of death in its line. You know, what David had done, brethren and sisters, was, and I love this figure because I think it's very true to life, and I once heard Brother David Pogson use this illustration about temptation, and he said, we're sometimes very good at just pulling down the blind on our moral faculties so that we can't see what will prick our conscience. Then we rush into sin and the blind goes up and we're horrified at the result. Well, David's just like that. And no doubt, David, though he proceeds into sin and breaks two of the commandments, of the Ten Commandments, and then later a third, there's no doubt David's conscience was deeply troubled through all of that. David was just not immune to all that God had thought or said. He was probably a little vulnerable and low at the time. But his mind was still able to understand just exactly what he was doing. You know, previously he'd hid the word in his heart. Now, there was that influence still there, but it wasn't as sharp as it should have been. And now he's in deep trouble. But of course, with all sin, brethren and sisters, this is a very interesting illustration of the way sin works, and not that we need explanations of that. We all know the experience, don't we, brethren and sisters? But he hopes no one knows. He hopes no one knows. And he hopes that time will just take away the sting of the pain of his conscience, which is plaguing him. And what we see here is a picture of David outplaying our own experiences. And time passes, and he thinks, well, no one knows. It's all right. It's something that happened, and he's put it aside. Until verse 5, and the woman conceived and sent and told David, I am with child. And while his conscience might have been getting used to the circumstance before, now it's enlivened again, and he's met with a circumstance he didn't want to hear, and new panic sets in now. Already sin was working its transforming power in deceiving his own mind, which sin does so amazingly on us, brothers and sisters. You know, we know that. We know that sin actually deceives us. It anesthetizes our conscience. We know that as a fact. And yet, as soon as we're in that circumstance, we can't see it. We're blind to it once we've actually gone into sin. And here we've got to learn from David, because he's trying to teach us something, that you never get to that point. But David's there. And now comes a whole chain of events in the cover-up. Sin begets sin. And here, following the same pattern as Adam and Eve, where they tried to conceal their sin. It's a very natural thing to do, isn't it, brothers and sisters? Oh, we chastise our children for not telling the truth and trying to hide things from us. But every one of us knows what that feels like. We're all in this boat together, brethren and sisters. We're in it with David as well, and David tried to do the same. David didn't want everyone else to know. He didn't want to face it himself. You know, perhaps David's attempts to conceal this sin appear to be more horrific only because he had the power to accomplish them. You know, brothers and sisters, we don't have the power to actually do what he did to cover our sin. And perhaps if we did, we might be as black as he was in this picture. Because he was king. He was not only king, brothers and sisters, he was virtually ruler of the entire Middle East. He was answerable to no one but God. And for the moment, he'd pushed God out. So his plan was, well, we'll get Uriah back. That'll fix it. It'll cover it. It'll look natural. It'll be all right. I can do this. I can organize this. So he calls Uriah back. But Uriah doesn't cooperate, because Uriah has too much integrity. Because Uriah has the integrity that he's learned from David. So David doesn't want to think about that, because it's too painful to think about. If he'd thought that Uriah was actually acting like he had in the past, it might have brought him to heel. But he didn't think that way. So he tries again. In fact, he deceives Uriah. He says, look, I'll send you back tomorrow. But then he gets him drunk that night and tries to send him back to his own wife. But that doesn't work either, because even in a drunken state, Uriah had more integrity than David. Things are going bad. And a million schemes must have gone through his mind. And he decided he had to kill Uriah. And he'd send a letter by his own hand. You know, we can scarcely believe this of David, of this man, after God's own heart. An adulterer, a deceiver, a liar, a murderer. This is the man who cared for the poor and needy. This is the man who searched and found Mephibosheth and took him in his own house and sat him in his own table. A useless man who he had there because he wanted to show the kindness of Yahweh to him. And he did this to countless other people. This is the man whose conscience was smitten because he cut the corner of Saul's skirt off. He's now writing a letter to Joab, whose attitude he despised, to be an accomplice, to kill one of his greatest warriors, one of his most faithful and trusted men, just had to be sacrificed to cover one rotten sin. Oh. Can you believe that of David? Look where he's got to, brothers and sisters. Verse 25 of chapter 11. This is what he says after he receives the message that Uriah's dead. And David said unto his messenger, "Thus shalt thou say to Joab, Oh, let not this thing displease you, for the sword devoureth one as well as the other. Make the battle more strong against the city and overthrow it. Encourage thou him." Oh, David is a million miles from where he normally actually was, from where the compass of his life had gone, on the death of a faithful and loyal and mighty man. He speaks like that. And that wasn't just him, because he'd sacrificed unnumbered soldiers in the process and made many families fatherless as a result of this. It wasn't just Uriah and many women widows. This is the destructive and transforming power of sin that twists our lives, brothers and sisters. We know its power. Well, you know, I actually don't think that we do often. And David was in the middle of this and he didn't see it. He was deceived and he kept on trying to deceive himself that it wasn't that bad. Well, Uriah dies. Was expedient that he do. Verse 26, and the wife of Uriah heard that her husband was dead, and she mourned for her husband. She didn't know what had happened. David's still holding that from her. David doesn't mourn. In fact, inwardly, he's probably rejoicing that this part of his plan is actually working. And verse 27 says, and when the morning was past, David sent and fetched her to his house, and she became his wife, and bare him a son. The plan seems to be going well. Nothing can get in its way now. All we need to do is have the dust settle, and no one will know anything about this. No one will worry. No one will ask any questions. But things didn't settle, brothers and sisters, as we well know. Just come to Psalm 32 for a minute. This is one of the two psalms that were written by David after the revelation of his sin. Verse 3, when I kept silence, he said, my bones waxed old through my roaring all the day long. This was not just a periodic thing that crossed his mind. It plagued him. He was a man after God's own heart. He just couldn't get rid of this. He couldn't expunge it from his mind. For day and night thy hand was heavy upon me. My moisture is turned into the drought of summer. Think about this, he says, because this was an incredible experience for him. This was God at work through all that period. His conscience, through his conscience, God was working and twisting and turning that harder and harder and making it more and more difficult, making him come to realize that he was fighting his conscience. David had stopped praying. He couldn't pray. He'd stopped reading. And he didn't want to read. And now it was physically affecting him. And he'd joined the class of the wicked who refused to confess. And all along, God had providentially tried to intervene. The messenger had come back and said, This is Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah, David. Uriah didn't cooperate, and David should have taken the providential hints from that. You know, brothers and sisters, we're just the same. When we're plagued by events or a conscience that's bad, we've got to learn to stop, because God is bringing us to repentance. David didn't stop here. It wasn't until, between 9 and 12 months, probably, that God eventually sent Nathan, the prophet. Bathsheba had already given birth to the son. And all that period, God had waited. And all that period, David had not prayed, had not confessed, hoping all the time that this whole wretched thing would go away. But he was desperately unhappy. He couldn't concentrate. He was depressed. He became physically ill through this period. But God had given him a chance to deal with it. But he hadn't. So he sent Nathan. In chapter 12, verse 1, Yahweh sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and told him this amazing story. It's very much like one of the parables of our Lord, isn't it? And the objective was to get him into a frame of mind to see the enormity of sin. You know, brothers, I think we can learn a great deal from Nathan's parable. Because here is a man that has been a righteous man. He's been in the truth, that is David. And he's in trouble. He's not tracking well at all. In fact, he's committed adultery and he's murdered someone. Yeah, he's not tracking well. But Nathan didn't come and say, "Listen, what are you doing going around killing people or taking other people's wives?" He came and gently allowed David to see for himself the severity of what he had done. He painted a story gently and led him there. And only at the appropriate time, when David is already starting to see what's going on, he says, "You're the man." Perhaps we can all learn a lesson about how to deal with our brethren, how to encourage them and lead them to a better way when they're caught. But this amazing story never ceases to touch us, does it? Two men, one rich, the other poor. The rich one had everything. The poor one had nothing but one little ewe lamb. Look at verse 3. "Which he had brought and nourished up, and it grew up together with him and with his children, and he'd eat of his own meat and drank of his own cup and lay in his bosom and was unto him as a daughter." Now that's a picture of the relationship between Uriah and Bathsheba. Uriah didn't have a harem. He just had one precious little ewe lamb that he nourished and cared for and that lay on his bosom. And David had come and ripped that little ewe lamb out and smashed that picture, that beautiful picture in that house. There came a traveller unto the rich man, and he spared to take one of his own flock and his own herd to dress it for the wayfaring man that was come unto him, but took the poor man's lamb and dressed it for the man that was come. And you can just see how David reacted. David, in an emotional outburst, because he was touched by that story, said, "He'll die, this man will die." Well, by the law, he wouldn't have died. And in fact, David then corrects himself and says, "Oh, he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing, and because he had no pity." You know, he had no pity. That's out of David's mouth. It's certainly not the real David, is it? And it was only then, after David had really grabbed that story, that he said, "David, you are the man." Have you ever stopped and thought about that scene, brothers and sisters? What that would have done to David. If David was a despotic, ungodly man, he would have grabbed Nathan and chucked him out of his court. But David stands there motionless as the enormity of everything that's happened over 12 months just crashes in around him. And suddenly he knows that God knows. Of course he knew God would know. But he'd hidden that away from his consciousness for 12 months. He'd pushed God out to the point that he didn't even really consciously think that God would know anything. But now it strikes him like a thunderbolt that God actually knows all about this. And he sees himself truly for the first time in months. He sees the true David as he is right now, a monster, a murderer, a cruel, rich man with no pity, an adulterer, a deceiver, a liar. And then he sees, as he thinks, this tender relationship that he's smashed to pieces. And then it even goes further, because he sees what he's done to his father. All the past events flick past his mind in rapid succession. You know, we may not have a prophet that comes to us, brethren and sisters, but we may have a faithful friend who speaks the word. Or we may open our Bibles and hear or read, "Thou art the man." We've probably all had that experience. And in a word, the caricature of our sin is horrific, just like it was painted here to David in the story. But the precursor to forgiveness, brethren and sisters, and this is where God was starting with this man, and what we learn about God, he'd waited all that time patiently for the right time for David to turn. And the precursor to forgiveness was for David to see himself as he really was, to see sin in his life for what it was. And when David saw that, he was utterly appalled and broken. And when we come to see, brothers and sisters, the way God actually sees sin in our lives, that's how we feel. But we don't feel that too often. You know the story that Jesus gave of the parable of the mote and beam? You know, we laugh at the story and, oh, we know what it all means. But you know what the implication of that is, brothers and sisters? Is that when, in fact, we are in sin, we have no idea how bad it is. No idea at all how bad it is. Our perception is completely wrong almost every single time we are in sin. And if someone else from outside speaks to us, they are much more likely to be accurate. We need to listen to each other. We need to listen to the word, because it's the only thing that's going to say, you are the man. And until we get to that point, like David got to here, brothers and sisters, there was no other way forward until he got there. Because sin had had such a deceiving effect on David's mind. It distorted his view like it distorts ours. And that's why we need to keep so close to the word. You know what Matt was saying at the camp on the weekend? We need to just keep there. We can't get away for very long before we start seeing things all wrong again. And as David's mind races on, all manner of things just churning around at a pace that he could hardly keep up with. Nathan goes on, verse 7. And he said, thus saith Yahweh Elohim of Israel, I anointed thee king over Israel and delivered thee out of the hand of Saul. And I gave thee thy master's house and thy master's wives into thy bosom, and gave thee the house of Israel and of Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have moreover given unto thee such and such things. Wherefore hast thou despised the commandment of Yahweh? What did that do to David? It was like a sword that just pierced right through him. Despising the commandment of Yahweh. It's the last thing David ever thought in his whole life he would ever do, to despise the commandment. He'd watched Saul do it time and time again. He'd watched Saul reject the word and disobey. He'd seen many people do it that chased him all around the country. And now he's accused of despising the word of Yahweh. He must have been thinking, no, no. But he had to face it, brothers and sisters. That's what sin is in our lives. Do we understand that? Do we understand that when we sin, brothers and sisters, we're despising the word of Yahweh? As Brother Harry Tennant said, the tattered rags of David's self-protection were torn aside, leaving him uncovered and ashamed. But it had to happen. He could no longer go on thinking in the deception that sin had led him to. He's the despiser of the word. Now it's repeated in verse 10. Thou hast despised me, David. Oh, Saul must have come back into his mind. As David joined the ranks of Saul, he must have been thinking that God would just cast him off like he did Saul. You know, we know that he thought that, and we won't turn to it now, but in Psalm 51 and verse 11 and 12, he says, cast me not away. Cast me not away like you did, Saul. He doesn't actually add that last bit, but that's the clear implication. And taken away not thy Holy Spirit from it like you took it away from Saul. And restore unto me the joy of thy salvation. Don't send me out and reject me. He thought he deserved all that had come to Saul. But Nathan wasn't finished yet. Verse 9. Thou hast despised the commandment of Yahweh to do it even in his sight. Thou hast killed Uriah the Hittite with a sword, and hast taken his wife to be thy wife, and slain him with the sword of the children of Ammon. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from thine house, because thou hast despised me, and hast taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be thy wife. You killed a man, so you lose four of your sons. Verse 11. Thus saith Yahweh, behold, I will raise up an evil against thee out of thine own house, and I will take thy wives from before thine eyes and give them to thy neighbour, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of the sun. For thou didst it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. You killed Uriah and the faithful soldiers, you'll lose sons. You wrecked a household. You took a man's wife. Your household will be wrecked. and your wives will be taken. You as the king did this in secret. I'm going to broadcast it upon the housetops. And David's reaction, verse 13. And David said, I have sinned against Yahweh. Simple. Complete. No excuses, no blame, no mitigating circumstances. Against thee only have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight. He was later to write in Psalm 51, which is an expansion of this confession. What about the hurt to Uriah and Bathsheba? Well, all sin is against God, first and foremost, and it would not be sin against a fellow unless God had first pronounced the rights and wrongs concerning our behaviour. So sin against God is the core of the problem, and David knew it, brethren and sisters. And actually, Nathan indicated that. Did you notice in verse 9, it says, first, you've despised the commandment of Yahweh, and then he says what the specific other things are. And then again repeats that, because you've despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah. Two times there. He actually puts God right at the front. This is the core of the problem, David. And David actually knew it was the core. But the amazing thing in verse 13 is that Nathan said unto David, Yahweh also hath put away thy sin, thou shalt not die. You know, on two counts, David should have died. An adulterer and a murderer was to die. There was no provision under the law for those crimes, and he should have lost his life. And yet here, there's this amazing response from God. Immediately he's received forgiveness. You know, David looked at that whole thing, brethren and sisters, and as it ran down through his mind, and he's thinking about all of that, as he'd churned over and over and over and over for months and months before, but never actually come to the point where he could confess that before God and open himself completely to him. Now he does, with complete openness, comes to God and confesses, it's all my fault. I did it all, God. He hated what he saw with an absolute passion and confessed all of that. And that moment, brothers and sisters, vowed that he would forsake that forever. And you know, he did. We never ever find David repeating this sin. He never ever did. And Proverbs chapter 28 and verse 13 says this, he that covereth his sin shall not prosper, but whoso confesseth and forsaketh them shall have mercy. And David actually found it in a most amazing way, at a time and at a point where he thought there's no way that God could ever accept him. He was as good as a dead man, even when he said before Yahweh, I've sinned against Yahweh. I think David actually realized that he was worthy of death, and that God could rightly just take his life there and then on the spot. And the prophet came straight back and said, God's forgiven you. What an amazing thing. You know, Psalm 51 is a commentary on this. Just come there for a minute. Psalm 51. There's a commentary on his confession. And while we haven't got time really to look at anything in very great detail here, but let's just have a look at verse 4. He says, for I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. Against thee the only have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight, that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest and be clear when thou judgest. There's his full confession, brethren and sisters, and it includes a declaration that of the righteousness of God as the basis for his forgiveness. Now, he didn't even ask for forgiveness at that point. He didn't even expect forgiveness at this stage. But he put God in the right. God was right in condemning him to death. God was right in passing sentence, if he wanted to say, David, you're finished. But now he received that the the statement of his forgiveness. He stood in awe at Yahweh's mercy that was shown to him. Look at verse 1. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, and according unto the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions, and wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin. You know, David's mind's actually back in Exodus chapter 34, you know, the declaration by God of his character when Moses said, show me thy way. Show me what your character is like. And God revealed to Moses that he said, you know, I am Yahweh, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity, transgressions and sins. And there David uses all those terms, iniquities, transgression and sins, in the first two verses. In fact, he uses them again and again through this chapter. But five times he says, they're mine. They're all mine. Whatever dimension of sin is, it's mine, God. And I own it. I own it. But not only that, he calls on God to have mercy according to his loving kindness, which is exactly what God had said when he revealed himself. He said that I will have mercy and I will forgive. So David's mind's coming to tune again completely as he wrote this and understood the basis on which God was going to be prepared to forgive. The exercise of God's mercy was not by works. It was going to be through grace and by faith. And David's use of all of these terms just show how he sees himself as just worthy of nothing. There's nothing David could do. He couldn't go and make an offering. What he says in verse 16, for thou desirest not sacrifice, else would I give it. Thou dost light us not in burnt offering. There was nothing he could do. But he knew what God wanted. Verse 17, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. And there comes the most important characteristic that God was looking for. You know, David knows too that he needs cleansing. Not only forgiveness, he knew he needed that, but he knew that he needed cleansing inwardly. So he says in verse 6, thou desirest truth in the inward parts, and in the hidden part thou shalt make me to know wisdom. So purge me and wash me and make me to hear gladness. Verse 10, and create in me a clean heart and renew a right spirit in me. Verse 12, restore unto me the joy of thy salvation and uphold me in thy free spirit. You know, he knew, brethren and sisters, he couldn't do this alone. That he needed God, and it was God's work in him. It was going to be the effect of God's work, both through chastising and through the effect of the word on his mind. This miraculous work that he was asking for was going to be a work of time that was going to transform and heal the scars and effects of sin. And then he wants to teach others. Verse 13, then will I teach transgressors thy way, and sinners shall be converted unto thee. You know, this psalm provides a vital role in Scripture. In fact, the whole event of David's sin does, brethren and sisters, because it does something that is not possible in Christ. Because Christ could not provide a model of how a righteous man should react to sin in their life, because he had never sinned. And so David, as the man after God's own heart here in the Old Testament, becomes that example of a man that has been godly, that falls into sin. How does he find his way back to God? And so the whole of this incident, therefore, brethren and sisters, becomes the basis of the illustrations that Paul uses in Romans about how God will forgive on the basis of his grace, not because anyone's done anything, but because they've confessed and forsaken and come to God in faith, believing that he can forgive and that his mercy will cover. And truly it will. So above all, brethren and sisters, this highlights This whole incident highlights the wonder of the grace of God. David deserved death, yet God patiently persisted with him and led him step by step to the realization of sin, to his confession of sin, to his repentance from it, and provided him with forgiveness. And for David, from this moment on, the mercy of God was not just words, but a wonder. A wonder that became the motive power of his life. And David's going to teach us. As he says in Psalm 32, blessed is the man whose sins are forgiven, in whom there is no guile. What an amazing thing it is, brethren and sisters, that out of such a horrific experience in this man's life, God was going to make a great example. And through this man, he was going to establish the principle of justification by faith on the basis of God's grace. So David says in Psalm 32, don't turn to it now, he says this, for this shall everyone that is godly pray unto thee in a time when thou mayest be found. Surely the floods of great waters, they shall not come nigh unto him. Thou art my hiding place. Thou shalt preserve me from trouble. Thou shalt compass me about with songs of deliverance. And so he taught all generations who would follow him after that the way to God is through forsaking sin and coming to God, not hiding it, but opening out before him in confession and understanding the enormity of the sin and forsaking it and seeking the miraculous power of God in his life through his word to transform and to cleanse and to purge and to create internally a new spirit and a right heart.